It's March Madness, y'all. We got some basketball right here in Minneapolis. It's a ton of fun. It's great. Sports have been a big deal in my life, right? And sports are kind of a big deal in a lot of people's lives. A lot of people do some kind of sports, some sort of activity, you know, and it's always, like, it kind of shaped me into the guy I am, both quite literally physically, like I'm a bigger guy because I played football, and because, like, it taught me a lot of morals and stuff like that. And my coaches were instrumental in that. You know, and I'm blessed because I've had a lot of really good coaches. You know, people in my life who helped sort of keep me on the straight and narrow when I was starting to sway a little bit. People who sort of reminded me of what the game was all about. People who sort of kept me, you know, with my eyes focused on the end goal. But of course we know, especially in the news, that there are not really good coaches out there, right? So we have these really great model coaches, and then we have coaches who give the whole game a bad name. And since we're talking about basketball, the name that comes to my mind is Bobby Knight, right? You know, the guy who would throw, you know, folding chairs across the basketball court, and he was, you know, verbally and physically abusive to his players. He eventually was prohibited from coaching in the NCAA. You know, this sort of really bad coach. And today, that's kind of how I want to envision, like, the Pharisees and scribes, aka bad coaches, And Jesus, right, the good coach, right, the head coach, and I suppose part of this is I myself really take to that moniker, right? Like I studied for 11 years to become a priest. I love being called Father. Like, you know, whenever it's, you know, Father RJ, I kind of turn around, yeah, it's me, you know, and I'm excited. But I had this privilege. Part of my formation was teaching and coaching for 3 years in Detroit at the University of Detroit Jesuit High School and Academy. I coached football. And I can tell you what, if I'm having a rough day and a kid would just come in and be like, hey, coach, yeah, what's up? Like, it just lightens my heart. Like, still being called coach is a big deal, you know, and it because I know how special that role was for me, right? How important coaches were in my life. So I know, like, you know, I gravitate to the name coach. So it still sort of holds a lot of ideas. And I feel safe sort of using a unique lens to look at this particular story. Because, you know, if you read the story, actually this story of the woman caught in adultery is sort of out of place in the Gospel of John right here. Right? Up until this point, Jesus has been having really serious and really sort of, you know, intense debates with the leaders of the Jewish people at this point, and he's just been, you know, kind of philosophically debating them. And then suddenly this story, which feels more like, you know, the Gospel of Luke, if you will, kind of comes out and sort of talks about how Jesus, you know, has this moment. It's much more almost parable-like than what we've been seeing in John so far. So tradition doesn't know exactly what to do with it, so I figure, hey, I'm going to use my coach lens, and we're going to try to interpret this through this coach view. And, you know, we kind of begin, those bad coaches are trying to distort the game. They're trying to catch Jesus in some sort of trap. They're trying to, you know, twist the game to their own advantage. And really, the problem is this poor woman is now a pawn, right? Her actions are immaterial to the actual story. She is a pawn for other leaders in order to sort of make something happen. And what they're trying to catch Jesus in is sort of like, hey, you know, if he says one thing, we got him. If he says another, we got him. Sort of this catch-22 situation. And here are the two situations, right? If Jesus looks and says, hey, listen, guys, let her alone, let her be, it's okay, you know, then the leaders can look and say, listen, this guy doesn't do tradition. He doesn't believe in sort of what we believe in. So clearly he can't be the Christ. He can't be who he says it is. So we've got him trapped, right? So if he doesn't agree with us, we've trapped him. But then if Jesus says, yeah, all right, okay, so Moses said to stone her, you know? And then that would go against everything that Jesus has been talking about, right? The entire gospel is filled with Jesus proclaiming that God is merciful and loving. And so if he says, yeah, well, I guess that's what the rules say, let's follow the rules, suddenly he's trapped. And he's now a hypocrite. And so they have that to use against him. But Jesus, the good coach, right? Like any good coach who's trying to figure out the next play, the next move, he sort of centers, he zens himself, he figures it out, and he does something amazing, especially in that time. He gets down and just sort of starts writing. Now, to a first century audience, like, what he's doing is clear. you know, we might think of it more like we're basically, sort of swiping do not answer on the phone. Or maybe we're putting it on like, you know, airplane mode or whatever it is you do to ignore that call you're not trying to answer. Right? He just doesn't play the game. He doesn't engage. Right? And so by him sort of actually disengaging from the authorities, you can tell the story sort of says, well, they get a little more anxious. They're like, they start peppering him with more questions. They start sort of saying, hey, what's going on? And then he says this great line. He stands up and he says, let the one without sin cast the first stone. Right, and so the gospel tells us that, you know, beginning with the elders, right? So here at St. Thomas More, that would be like our eldest would be like, you know, Father Warren. That's a point. He's not here, but he's going to hear about it. Right, so, you know, beginning with like somebody like Father Warren's age, which is old, I know. And then, you know, and going down with each and every one, there's sort of this response that they have. And commentators are going to kind of have two different versions of this. One set of commentators will say that, you know, that it's the oldest, the elders who have the most sin, so they're the ones who sort of realize, well, they can't, you know, so they go away first, right? Sort of, they realize, well, it can't be me, so I'm just going to go away. Other commentators, and this is why I think if we look at it through this lens, it actually fits in where we've placed it in tradition in the Gospel of John. You see, in the Gospel of John in this point, in the chapters before and the chapters after this little story, the Jewish leaders are actually arguing with each other about who Jesus is. They're arguing with each other about, like, what do we do with this person called Jesus Christ? They don't know what to do, right? And so I think if we use this lens to interpret why the elders left, I think it helps fit this story, and it's this. The elders realized that they had been beaten. But not just beaten, right? Beaten in the kind of way where you're like, man, that guy's good. You know, beaten in the kind of way where you're like, man, I want to be transformed, right? That the elders themselves actually have a moment in which they recognize through their wisdom that they can be transformed in this moment. And so they peel away, not because they still have this murderous desire, but because they've been transformed. And then so on and so forth, everyone sort of leaves until it's just Jesus and the woman. And remember, Jesus is sitting down here, he's still writing. And now I use a lot of Ignatian imagination as I sort of prepare for these. So, like, I'm kind of using my mind's eye, like, what would happen, right? Like, how long was he writing, right? Because anything more than, like, 30 seconds, it's already awkward, right? If she's standing there and he's writing. But I also imagine that when Jesus looks up, and when he looks at her, he doesn't waste this moment. It's not accidental. He doesn't just simply kind of roll his eyes and be like, well, is nobody else here? But he takes this moment, and he uses it. He looks her directly in the eye. And with the kind of love that I imagine only Jesus really can convey just with his eyes, he looks at her and says, is anyone left to condemn you? And I imagine her response is this sort of soft, like broken, embarrassed kind of response. And when she says, no, sir, no one. And I imagine that in that moment, Jesus matches her pitch, matches her tone, and says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. You know, that in that moment, this pawn, this sort of this ancillary person, really becomes whole again, becomes who she's meant to be again. She becomes the beloved of God, who God says, go and become who you are meant to be. So in some ways, Jesus is changing the game, right? But Jesus is sort of changing the game the way that we look at a lot of great players or a lot of great teams. I was rooting for a particular team. You know, I spent some time in Detroit, so you could probably guess which team I was rooting for. But yesterday, that Texas defense, one could say they changed the game. Right? They didn't actually transform the game. They didn't cheat. They just were so dynamic in what they were doing, we could say, wow, that's changed the way people might play from now on, right? And this is what I mean, I think we understand when we say that Jesus changed the game. He's changed it because he's transformed it. It isn't a new game per se, but it is new because we've seen, wow, we can do something amazing with this. And our other readings this weekend share that same theme, right? Our first reading sort of harkens back to the Israelites escaping Egypt. When God delivers Israel, he delivers them on dry land through water, right? The miracle there is that dry land appears where it shouldn't be, right? Right in the middle of a sea. And Israel is able to walk through that boom and be saved. But the readings today that God is going to do something new, is going to do something transformative. God is going to make water where there was none. And it will be through water, my friends, that we are saved. Right? This, the waters of baptism. The waters of salvation. And Paul, I love it. Like, Paul can sometimes be a little hoity-toity, right? Paul can sort of, like, be judgy, you know? But Paul today is at his best because he says, everything I learned before, everything I knew before, that's rubbish. It is rubbish when I compare it to the knowing and being in relationship with Jesus Christ. And what I love is he says, he doesn't say, I've got it, here's how you get it. He says, this thing, this person of Jesus Christ, this is a journey. This is part of the process. This is a part of growing. This is a part of being transformed. And he invites us on that journey with him. And so that's the challenge for us today. To hear Jesus looking and talking to us as he talked to the woman. To be transformed through those signs and symbols, the sacraments, dare I say, in which we participate, in which we eagerly await, and in fact in which one of us in this congregation will be transformed quite literally at the Easter Triduum. It's my invitation to bring up Martin... It is Martin, right? No, that's your last name. What's your first name? Miller. Martin Miller, sorry. And bring him up for the third scrutiny for this Easter season. These scrutinies are part of the church's way of sort of examining. And it isn't like scrutiny the way we sort of scrutinize a test or scrutinize something like this. It's a scrutiny in which we look at Martin in the same way that Jesus looked at the woman, with love, with joy, and an invitation to this transformation. So I invite you up forward at this time with your sponsor.